VFBS, Original Forces Programs.
This is BFBS,
the Forces Station.
So during these unprecedented times, we've been talking to quite a lot of interesting people. One of them is former Royal Marine and ocean rower Mick Dawson. How are you, Mick?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for the invite to talk to you again.
We couldn't not talk to you. Some of the stories were just incredible. So let's go all the way back to the beginning. So tell us about your career as a Royal Marine.
Oh, that's a memory test. Basically, I joined up at 16 in 1980. I was 16 in June and walked through the gates of Limpston on August the 4th, 1980. No particularly spectacular career really to speak of. I had 11 fantastic years in the Corps, had a thoroughly good time, and then decided to pursue my real passion, that was going to sea, and I left after 11 years. I guess the highlight was going to the Falklands. I was fortunate enough to have my 18th birthday 2 days before the surrender.
How were you feeling before you set off for the South Atlantic?
Well, I think looking at it now, as a much older person, I was lucky that I was very young, as most people are in those situations. So you think you're immune, you think you're immortal. I was excited by it. Like pretty much everybody in the Marines, it was an opportunity to do your job. If you spoke to anybody in the services, they would say that's what they joined up to do. And it was a unique war to be involved in. I think we were very, if fortunate is the right word to use, I think if you're going to be involved in a war, that's the one to be involved in, because there was going to be a winner or a loser. It was going to be finished in a certain period of time. There were no ambiguities about refugees or even in the right or wrong of it, in my particular view. So it was a very conventional and straightforward conflict to be involved in, not like some of the others that obviously have lingering effects that go on for years and years afterwards.
And did you see action during the Falklands?
Oh, yeah. I was part of air defence troop then as a very young Marine. Literally just come out of training to Norway on my first deployment. Stepped out of the BV when we took them ashore in Plymouth, waiting to go on Easter leave, and was told you're not going on Easter leave. And 3 days later, we were on a ship heading south to the Falklands. It was an epic trip there and back. I mean, we came back on a cruise liner on the Canberra from the Falklands. I mean, that is just such a surreal experience, coming back into the UK and being greeted. It's like something like from the coronation of British people greeting us into the UK.
Tell me a little bit about the first track that you've picked out for us today.
It's a track called The Bed and Breakfast Man, and it's by Madness, appropriately enough. I remember in particular the night before I joined up, when the reality of what the step I was taking, listening to this track on a cassette recorder that I was basically playing on loop by hand all night because I couldn't sleep, because I was so nervous. I was that scared about what was happening the following day. So The Bed and Breakfast Man was the track that always takes me back to that night before I joined the Royal Marines, basically the last night as a civilian.
Some of his ways, he just can't.
Okay, so Mick, you've just turned 18. You've finished your time in the Falklands. You're back in the UK. What happened within your career next?
After the Falklands and doing it at such a young time, everything after that was an anticlimax. I was quite fortunate in that immediately we came back, it was discovered after the Falklands that there was a huge problem with the Royal Navy ships in that they could be hit in certain places and lose all the power. So we then had basically a four-year deployment, my troop, providing an independent air defence system out in the Gulf. This was when Iraq was our friends, and they were fighting Iran, and we were basically patrolling and guarding the container ships that went up and down the Straits of Hormuz. So it was as near operational as you could have on a regular basis. So for the 4 years after that, it was fantastic. But if I'm honest, and I look back on it now, I think going to the Falklands as my first real deployment made the whole of the rest of the career very much an anticlimax for me. That sounds like a really negative word, because I had a fantastic time in the Corps, but I think I was always looking to repeat that experience, and it never quite came.
So how did you come about your life of adventure once your career in the Marines wound down?
I don't like a career, but the path down adventure started with joining the Marines. Just the training was an adventure. Best of all, I learned to sail in the Marines with a joint services sailing club, and that was a big step for me. And that really led to my exit from the Marines, because that gave me a pathway to a career as a professional sailor outside the Corps. You know, you always think the grass is greener. It's not always the case. I went out of the Marines and eventually became a professional sailor with private yachts. And it's frankly quite a shallow environment, especially after being in an environment like the Royal Marines, where people routinely put their life on the line for you. And then you're dealing with people who won't give you 2 minutes of the time unless there's a monetary value to it. And I found that very, very difficult. And I think that's probably something a lot of ex-service personnel find, that when they go into Civvy Street, the value system's different. And it took me a lot of years to realise that it wasn't those people that weren't normal, it was me. I'd come from a very unique family environment, because that's ultimately what the services are. And suddenly I was in a world that was much more dog eat dog. And I really wanted something to give me something back that I'd lost when I left the services. Ultimately became ocean rowing, but it wasn't planned. The story behind that, bizarrely enough, I was in Italy on a refit for a large private yacht, helping a friend out. And I read a book called Into Thin Air, the Everest story of the worst year on Everest. Although tragic, it was a brilliant story about human endeavour. And I thought, right, I can eventually climb Everest. It was feasible within 3 years I could get to that level. So I set about planning that, and days later found out about an Atlantic rowing race, which had only ever taken place once. And I thought, the second incarnation I could take part in. And I could do that straight away. I didn't need a great deal of training for that. So I just entered into the Atlantic rowing race with my brother. And the rest is 20 years of history now.
Is it fair to say you escaped to the sea?
I think I was always destined to go there, and I just took a roundabout way of getting there. My time in the Corps was basically a huge amount of time at sea, a lot of ship deployments, the Armilla Patrol in the Gulf, obviously the Falklands. My relationship with the sea has just been full of positive experiences.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing. Somewhere beyond the sea, she's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, straight to her arms I'd go sailing. It's far beyond a star, it's near beyond the moon. I know beyond a doubt my heart will lead me there soon. We'll meet beyond shore, we'll kiss just as before. Happy we'll be beyond the sea and never. ever again I'll go sailing. Just as before, happy we'll be beyond the sea, and never again I'll go sailing, no more sailing, so long sailing, bye-bye sailing.
This is BFBS. The Forces Station.
Somewhere beyond the sea.
We've been speaking to former Royal Marine and ocean rower Mick Dawson, finding out about his incredible adventures at sea. So let's talk about your first Atlantic row. How did it all begin?
I found out about an Atlantic rowing race from the Canary Islands, from Tenerife to Barbados, 3,000 miles. It only ever been done once before. At that stage, literally only a few dozen people had successfully rowed across any ocean. So I entered the race, ordered the kit to build a boat to do the race in, and then contacted my brother to let him know that he was going to be my team member. Fortunately, he was a former Royal Marine by that time as well, so I knew that he'd be up for it, and he was.
So the two of you, you started this row, and this was in 2001. Obviously, you're very experienced as far as a sailor goes and all the stuff you've done as the Royal Marines. But this is your first attempt at anything like this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when we started the race, we had all sorts of complications at the beginning. It was a fiasco of how the race was organised or misorganised. And we had to do work on the boat at the last minute. And we actually got into the sea for the first time 15 minutes before the race start. They brought in some regulations on the boat that meant we had to rebuild the boat on the start line, which is why we got into the water 15 minutes before the start of the race. But to be honest, in many ways, it made it a better experience for us. We didn't think so at the time, but it made it a longer race. We had to overcome more problems, and we learned a lot more from that.
So what were some of the problems that happened then?
Very few people had had this experience. So we were learning when there were no lessons to be had before we left. And we were learning the tricks of how to use a parachute anchor. And that's basically a parachute you drop into the water, you stream it 80 to 100 metres behind the boat, and it will stop you being blown back as far when the wind's against you. And more importantly, it will make you less susceptible for capsizing the really big stuff. The biggest obstacle was that rush to get to the start line meant we weren't as well prepared as we might have been. We spent about the first week getting the water maker to work correctly so we had enough water. We had no communications at all on that trip for 70 days because, quite frankly, the kit available 20-odd years ago we couldn't afford, and there was not much that you could have in terms of voice communications that would work on a small boat. So we were completely on our own. The biggest step for me was we pushed off onto the Atlantic in flat, calm conditions. And I look back at the pictures of that now, and it looks like we're on a mill pond. And within 12 hours of that picture, the first night at sea, we were in mountainous seas as an Atlantic gale kicked up, and we were looking at 30, 40-foot waves behind the boat. So it's quite a tight learning curve.
Did you guys complete that first Atlantic row?
Oh, yeah. We completed it in 70 days. Believe it or not, typically arrogant former Royal Marines, we expected to do much better. That was never going to happen with all the hassle we had rebuilding the boat. But we got there at 70 days, and we were actually disappointed because we thought we'd let people down, because we thought we'd be in it around 50 days, a lot quicker. And when we arrived at Barbados, we were 30 miles off the coast, a bit down on ourselves because we just didn't think we'd done it quick enough. We just rode the Atlantic and no few dozen people had done it, but we were kicking ourselves for that. And then we got hit by another storm. And we then spent the next 24 hours being absolutely smashed to pieces off the coast of Barbados with the risk of being smashed on the rocks. But we woke up the following morning and we'd gone past Barbados, and it now looked like we weren't going to get into the finish line at all. If we were down about how long it took us, we were absolutely destroyed by not finishing the race. So we spent about 6 hours, I think, that morning pulling the parachute anchor in from time to time, trying to get the boat pointing back to Barbados and seeing if we could row it back. And eventually I managed to get the boat pointing back towards Barbados, and we could keep it there with a storm decaying. We just thought, Arnold, if one of us can row and we can stay in the same position, that means if two of us rows, we can get, you know, we can make progress. And we did. We both set up the boat to row. And the first hour we rowed, we went 400 metres in the right direction towards Barbados. And we carried on like that for 24 hours together, non-stop, before we eventually racked up at the finish line in Barbados, where everybody was amazed to see that we'd made it. They actually thought we'd been towed back in.
So you finally managed to get yourself to the finishing line. What are your thoughts that first time that you stepped off the boat and on to land and to the finishing line?
The end of the first Atlantic rowing race for me is probably one of my best memories of all the ocean rowing adventures, because bizarrely, a motorboat came out to us and they were amazed that we'd made it back. There's loads of boats have been rescued and towed in. And one of the guys on the boat said, your family are stuck in customs. They're not actually at the finish line. Do you want to wait out here till they get here? It's kind of like, no, we don't really want to wait out here. And so we went in and there was a big welcome party, but no family. Sure enough, and we stepped off the boat, and about 10 minutes later, I was just drinking my first beer, and a taxi pulled up. My brother's wife and kids got out. My dad got out. My dad came over to me. I'll give him his due. The first thing he said was congratulations, and the next thing he said to me was, son, you'll never believe the journey I've had.
That's what your dad said.
Yeah, Manchester Airport was a bit of a nightmare.
I mean, you had no way of communicating when you were on this first Atlantic row. You were there with your brother, just the two of you. Do you think that this adventure brought you closer together?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we also benefited hugely from the fact that we were both former bootnecks. It was effortless. It was literally like going back in the core and going on exercise or ops. And we just fell into the routine. It was easy.
He really missed his family, even though he had you there and you're very close as brothers, but he really missed home, didn't he?
Yeah, it's one of the things probably was a surprise to both of us just about how much impact that has on a parent. And I've been with other rowers who have family and I've seen it have the same impact on them. I mean, on an ocean rowing boat where there's that threat, and I don't care where you are on an ocean boat, on any ocean, that threat that you might not be seeing somebody again. We had deck speakers on the boat constantly playing out music. One of the tracks on that playlist really summed it up for him and probably became the theme tune, and that was Oasis and Half the World Away.
I would like to leave this city. This old town don't smell too pretty, and I can feel the warning signs running around my mind. And when leave this island, I put myself into a soul asylum, 'cause I can feel the warning signs running around my mind. So here I go, still scratching around in the same old hole. My body feels young but my mind is very old. You know I'd stay, but I just can't stand it, and I can feel the warning signs
running around my mind. And if I could leave this spirit, I'd find me a hole and I'll live in it. And I could feel the warning signs running around my mind. Here I go, I'm still scratching around in the same old hole. My body feels young, but my mind is very old. So what do you say? You can't give me the dreams that are mine anyway. Half the world away, half the world away, half the world away. I've been lost, I've been found, but I don't feel down. No, I don't feel down. No, I don't feel down.
This is BFBS, the Forces Station.
Somewhere beyond the sea.
After you'd finished your first Atlantic row, you decided that you're going to set off and try a solo attempt in 2003. So tell me a little bit about the Pacific attempt.
When we were setting off to go across the Atlantic, there were two serving Royal Marines, Tim Welford and Don Mee, were attempting to become the first people to row from Japan to San Francisco, and we had followed their trip. A slightly younger vintage of Royal Marine than us. They were hit 1,300 miles from the coast of America, just at the point where they thought they were going to get in on the homeward leg. And it was heartbreaking. It was for us following them. And I said to Steve, right, this has just become a training run, and we'll go and finish that when we rode the Atlantic. You know, never look at the top of the hill, always look at the hill beyond it, and it became our hill beyond it. The only downside to it was that my brother realised by the end of the Atlantic that for him to go and attempt to row the Pacific with me, that's 6 months at sea in a much more hostile environment, and that wouldn't be fair on his kids. So he couldn't commit to that, and I didn't think anybody could replace him. So I decided I'd go and attempt to row the North Pacific on my own. The journey began before I got to Japan, really, because the first thing I did was contact Tim Welford and Don Mee to get their advice. I didn't know him directly then, they're great friends now, and they did gave me a huge amount of advice on that route and the difficulties. Basically, I went to Choshi, 70 kilometres north of Tokyo on the east coast, the bit of Japan nearest to San Francisco, coincidentally enough. And it's 4,546 miles as a great circle route to the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, I think, give or take. Ultimately, it's closer to 7,000 miles in an ocean rowing boat because there's a lot of going north, south and backwards when you're trying to row across the North Pacific.
Now, you experienced some incredible things on this journey, and you were there on your own. So let's go through some of the more sticky situations, Mick.
Yeah, I think the North Pacific, it just brings so many more challenges, from the navigational challenges, from the size of the ocean, from the remoteness of it, from the hostility of the weather and the sea. Probably the biggest problem I had, certainly the biggest fear, was shipping. It's all major shipping out on the North Pacific. And they simply, in 2004, when we're talking about this row, there was nothing on my boat technology-wise, it lit me up reliably on their radar. And four occasions, I rowed out from under the bows of container ships that were about to hit me. And when I say from under the bows, I mean 40, 50 yards in front of them, ploughing down on my 375-metre-long boat, bearing down on me at 20 knots, that's got no idea you're there. They, you know, you wouldn't even be a paint mark on the side of that ship if they hit you. I remember very well, actually, I'd come out of a week's worth of fog, because fog was another major consideration on that trip. That brings its own nightmares. I've never, ever been so glad to see a blue sky after 7 days in fog. So I was rowing in quite big seas, quite a strong following wind, and I got this sixth sense, which I often got on those trips, that something was behind me, basically, or something wasn't right. I looked over my shoulder, and there, not too far distance, was a huge container ship, and it was coming straight towards me. It was a big Maersk vessel. I knew immediately, because I got quite good at avoiding these things, what was going to happen, and I couldn't row across it fast enough. But worse than that, I was getting blown onto it. So I immediately threw a drogue over the side to slow my progress down and jumped onto the VHF and said, unknown vessel at whatever position it was, this is Ocean Rowing Boat, Mrs. D. I'm off your port bow and there's a risk of collision. Now, I could hear the guy on watch literally falling off his chair as he acknowledged this, but acknowledge it he did. And he immediately started to turn this huge ship to starboard, an emergency turn to starboard. Unfortunately, by this stage, I was so close to the ship, I was being forced onto it. This meant the back of the ship was now going to run me down. This ship was like about 350-360 metres long. I got straight back on the VHF and said, stop your emergency turn. You're going to go past me, but you're going to hit me if you don't. And I'm glad to say he did. He stopped it immediately. The guy's name was Palios Henrik from the Faroe Islands. He eventually introduced himself to me. And as the ship passed by, only 40, 50 yards away from me when it passed safely by in the end, it all calmed down. Now, on day 12 of this trip, I'd lost communications. My satellite phone had broken in a storm and it didn't work after that. So the one bonus about these near misses was I could speak to somebody and get a message home on the VHF. Or I could speak to them on the VHF. They would send a message home via satellite. So I said, oh, Palios, could I ask a favour? And he said, yeah, what's that, Mick? And I said, well, could you send a message home, let them know I'm okay? Obviously, don't tell them how we met, but everything's going okay, but the comms are down. He went, yeah, can I ask you a question though, Mick? And he said, what are you doing in the middle of the Pacific in a rowing boat? And I said, well, I was out fishing, because this conversation took place without me ever seeing him. The ship was disappearing over the horizon. It was just on the VHF radio. And the last thing this man ever said to me, I've never met, never seen, was, Mick, you English, you some crazy b****, which I've always taken as a great compliment. It was a big relief when they passed by and it was over, not least because it would convince me then it wouldn't happen for at least a while longer. And it was quite an exciting time afterwards, and the adrenaline would be pumping. If there's one song that, even when I hear it now, takes me back to that relief and the adrenaline flow afterwards, it's probably Outkast and Hey Yeah.
Just want to meet your mama. Oh, just want to meet. Beyonce's and Lucy Liu's. Shake it, baby doll. Shake it off the floor.
Get on the floor. Shake it like a Polaroid picture. Sugar, shake it. You know what to shake it. Sugar, shake it. Shake it. Sugar, shake it like a Polaroid picture.
Somewhere beyond the sea.
BFBS, the Forces Station.
It's so hard to even get your head around just being that insignificant to all of this traffic that's moving so quickly past you. I mean, that's just the man-made elements that were horrendous on this row. What about some of the natural elements that you came up against?
It was a constant battle against the North Pacific. In fact, the North Pacific very much took on a personality for me. It became an individual, really, and everything about it felt like it was trying to stop me. Typically arrogant human reaction to it. You think the Pacific's got nothing better to do than make my life difficult. But everything about it was attritional. And I remember it felt like I was a small child swinging for his dad and the father just holding the hand on the forehead so that the hits never made contact. And no matter how much you swang, it was useless. And that's what it felt getting across the Pacific. There was no following winds, no trade winds. It was battling every mile to get east. And quite regularly, I went backwards three times before I managed to go in the right direction and leave those positions behind. So it was a real battle against the elements, the ocean and the weather on the North Pacific. Ultimately, I would lose that battle. 109 days into that trip, at the point, pretty much the same location where the two Royal Marines were run down on their attempt, I came to grief. I'd actually got to the point where I thought I was on the home run. I know now there is no such thing as a home run on the North Pacific. Just over 1,000 miles away from the American coast in calm water, and I found myself capsized, trapped inside the boat. To this day, I don't know what caused it. I was in the cabin. I'd gone back into the cabin to get my camera to film a heavy rain downpour outside, which only served to flatten the water even more than it was. And while I was in there, the boat was basically rolled onto its roof. It wasn't an impact. It wasn't a whale hitting the boat. It wasn't a ship making contact. It didn't really matter. I was in trouble. As soon as the boat rolled over, I realized I'd closed the hatch, but I hadn't closed it on the watertight seal. And as it got onto the roof, it hemorrhaged water through that hatch. I closed it off as quick as I could, but enough water had got in that it slowed down the self-righting moment that's built into the boat. And despite me being inside like a very agitated hamster trying to get that boat upright, as she went round and got to the point where she was going to pop back up again and everything would have been okay, she stalled. And she hung there while I was doing my best to get her to go that last 10 degrees and come back upright. And she didn't. And she just dropped down on her side. And basically, I found myself trapped inside the cabin on starboard side with the front hatch half underwater, the aft hatch completely underwater. The only way to get that boat upright was for me to be outside. The only way to get outside was through one of those two hatches. As soon as I opened either hatch, the cabin was going to flood, the boat would turn turtle completely, and I would be in dire straits. I knew, without even thinking about it, I was now in a survival situation.
What was going through your mind at that point? I mean, were you scared? Were you thinking, this could be it for me?
No, and I say this honestly because I was terrified after the event, cold sweats for several days. But during the whole process, and I can only put this down to the training that I received as a Royal Marine, not me as an individual, but it gave me coping mechanisms to deal with it. And I dealt with it very straightforwardly. I don't remember at any point being afraid, although I was totally aware of the situation and the threat. And I don't remember feeling any self-pity or sorry for myself, anything like that. All I remember is immediately going into a routine of, right, I'm in a survival situation. I knew that. What's my plan out of it? And what do I need to do next? And that's basically how I survived. That whole episode I can put down to surviving purely because I had the good fortune to have been a Royal Marine.
Oh, my goodness. But the worst thing of all was that you knew that you weren't alone.
Perfect timing. I'd had one shark had rubbed itself down the side of the boat, the hull of the boat, the previous day. They do that to get the parasites off the skin, apparently, as well as to alarm ocean rowers. So finding myself, ultimately, I had to escape from the cabin and set myself up in a very small one-man life raft, an aircrew life raft, outside. It didn't take long to drift back to the fact that I'd had a shark down the side of the boat only the previous day. And, you know, the ocean's a small place when you're making lots of noise escaping upturned ocean rowing boats. The one long-range piece of equipment that I did have was an EPIRB, an emergency position indicating radio beacon, which sends an SOS at this position, no more information, and it's a once-only use on batteries, so it's got limited use before it goes off. I knew the boat was going to turn turtle completely by the following night, and I didn't want to be in there in the dark having to get out, so I made the decision to get out, A, because I didn't want to be in the boat upside down at night, and B, I was worried that that signal from that beacon wasn't getting out through the cabin walls. I had to open the hatch and basically exit that cabin. Once again, I was grateful for my time in the Marines. I'd done dunking drills on helicopters, so when the North Pacific come roaring through that hatch, freezing cold, and I had to stay in there until it filled up completely, I had some level of control, not to panic and drown in the cabin, because it was absolutely terrifying. When I had to make that decision, I opened the cabin hatch and that water flooded in and the boat turned turtle and I was still trapped inside as it flooded in. It wasn't a pleasant experience.
So, Mick, you've got one track that was very, very poignant to you that kind of sums up your whole time rowing solo across the Pacific in 2003. So tell me a little bit about this track.
I was being pushed back day after day, not particularly bad weather, but just constantly being stopped by attritional weather, even sometimes only 12 or 13 knots from the wrong direction, pushing me back. And I was probably as low as I've ever been and as close to giving up as I've probably ever got. And it was day after day. And then out of the speakers, this song called Charmed Life came out. I'd never heard it before, but one verse in particular came out of the speakers just at my lowest point. It was, sometimes life is like being afloat in a raging sea in a little rowboat with those waves just trying to wash you overboard. But if you take your chances and you ride your luck and never, 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 never give up, those waves will take you to a friendly shore. The power that one song at the right time had completely to change my mood and the energy that surrounded that situation. I went from being probably on the brink of defeat to being absolutely unbreakable. I was never, never going to give up, and I was going to get to that friendly shore. And the strange thing was, for 7 or 8 days after that, I was still getting pushed back. But the difference was my approach to that situation had changed, all on the back of that one record, and I wasn't going to be defeated. It was one of the probably biggest lessons I learned during all the rowing, that you sometimes can't change your circumstances, but you can always change your approach to a problem.
When I hold I hold you in my arms.
Somewhere beyond the sea.
BFBS.
The Forces Station.
Now, Mick, you're no stranger to finding yourself in turmoil at sea. I mean, especially being capsized, because it happened to you again, didn't it?
It did. I took part in the Atlantic rowing race in 2005, stepped in as a last-minute replacement on a boat where a crew member went home, and got myself involved in the worst conditions on that route for 100 years. And we were capsized, as were 26 other boats in that race at one time or another. I was actually on the deck and rowing along in really quite formidable seas, but making fantastic progress, when out of the blue a rogue wave came towards the side of the boat, caught us beam on, and long story short, basically I couldn't turn the boat into the conditions, and I ended up being not so much capsized as demolished by the wave. It was easily a 40-foot breaking wave, laid the boat on its side with me at the rowing position, crashed down on the boat, and the next thing I knew, I was tumbling around mid-Atlantic, separated from the boat, in the dark, in big seas. I came up absolutely desperate to find where that boat was, because if I missed it, I wouldn't get back to it. Unfortunately, I did see it, swam back to it as it re-emerged, upside down, but slowly self-righted. And as I got to the boat, it was self-righted. The water was pouring off it like something out of the Poseidon Adventure. And all I could hear blasting out the deck speakers was Robbie Williams, "Let Me Entertain You." It was a humorous end to a really, really dangerous situation. I could have easily lost my life at that point.
Another line.
Station.
Somewhere beyond the sea.
Now, Mick, you've seen some incredible things on your adventures at sea, and some things that are almost too difficult to explain, some things that we don't have answers for. So tell us about that.
Yeah, again, it was on the North Pacific, which was awash with close encounters with the wildlife. One night, I found myself surrounded by what appeared to be sea serpents. To this day, I haven't had an exact explanation as to what it is, and I don't have an exact explanation. But basically, I sat on the deck and very, very calm conditions, but pitch black with only the navigation lights illumination around me. All the fish that gathered beneath the boat for protection were suddenly being destroyed by large predators. That's not unusual, but I couldn't recognize the predators. And when they got rid of all the fish underneath my boat, as I was sat there at the rowing position, suddenly I saw an animal 18 inches out of the water staring directly back at me. Absolutely terrifying. Took me completely by surprise. And then it hissed. As scary an experience as I've ever had out on an ocean rowing boat, because this animal was literally out of the water, staring straight at me, and it was hissing, or I understand breathing, but it sounded like hissing at the time. And then I looked to my left, and another one, even closer, was out of the water, staring directly at me. And there's about eight of these animals that had decimated the fish that lived underneath my boat, and they were now, very, very aggressive predators, were now centering their attention on me. It was absolutely the most frightening period of time I've had on an ocean rowing boat. And to this day, I don't know what they were because I couldn't see in the darkness. I hopped along my ocean rowing boat very gingerly to the hatch, didn't disappear into the cabin at the back, but put one leg in there, got a pair of shorts on that were totally inadequate to protect my dignity, and a small diving knife and a torch. And I spent 45 minutes shining lights on these animals around my boat, trying to identify them. And every time I shone a light on them, they disappear under the water and pop up somewhere else. So I never really got to look at them. I've had explanations in that I've been somewhere that no one normally goes at that speed at night, 18 inches from the surface of the water. And I might have just seen something that nobody's seen before or not seen for a long time. All I'll know is that that's the one thing that has shook me up and genuinely frightened me on any of my ocean rows.
Gosh, that's just such an amazing story, Mick. It really is. Why do you do these things?
I've just got a passion for the sea. I literally grew up dreaming about being at sea on ships. I found out that ocean rowing was the best way to go to sea that I've ever been. It's like having the best seat at the best show in town, but the price of the ticket's quite expensive in terms of it's a hard thing to do to row across an ocean. But the upside to it, especially the wildlife, absolutely made it worthwhile. I must have had 60 or 70 close encounters with all manner of species of whale. That will live with me to my dying day. I was adopted, effectively, some might say stalked, by a pod of killer whales on that trip. And that was just the most amazing experience for somebody like myself, council estate background from Boston in Lincolnshire, to be within touching distance of a killer whale staring me directly in the eye, as happened to me on several occasions on that trip. That is an utter privilege, and it makes up for any discomfort that ocean rowing brings. And it does bring. It's hard work and it's uncomfortable, but the upsides far outweigh the down.
There's a lot of people at the minute and they're struggling with isolation. What would be your top tip to people listening to this today, having been in so many different extraordinary circumstances?
Well, I think my top tip It's something I learned very early on in the Raw Marines, and that is take it one day at a time. What's happening at the minute is on such a scale, and it's so unusual that if you look at it as a whole or try to guess when it's end or when it's going to change, it just overwhelms you. Much as rowing across the North Pacific would overwhelm you if you looked at it as one huge thing at once. So break it down into days. Get through this day, then we'll deal with the next day. And it also means that if something goes wrong, it goes wrong on that day, and then you move on with the next day instead of it weighing you down with the whole enormity of what's going on. And there are many, really, I learned on the ocean and rowing adventures, but if the one major tip that will get you through this, it's take it one day at a time.
Now, Mick, you've written a couple of books about your incredible experiences, and so great to hear your dit, because it takes you away to another place. It's just extraordinary. So tell us about the books that you've written and where people can find them.
Well, it's all been a privilege to me, but the biggest privilege is to write a book about those experiences and to be able to share them with other people. It's obviously a big personal thing for me, but to share them in book form is fantastic. First book is called Rowing the Pacific, and that covers all the rows up to the successful row to the Golden Gate Bridge in 2009. And my second book, Never Leave a Man Behind, is a very important book to me because it's about the story of two former Royal Marines who basically slipped through the system of support when they were struggling mentally and physically after their service. The biggest story in there is rowing the Pacific with Steve Sparks, who's blind. And when we rowed from California to Hawaii and he stepped off that boat, he became the first blind person ever to row the Pacific Ocean.
Former Royal Marine ocean rower Mick Dawson, it has been such a pleasure to spend some time with you. There are a lot of troops listening right around the forces world, and also our NHS workers, our Blue Light Service, working under extraordinary circumstances and, as I think we can all agree, extraordinary times. Have you got a message for the troops working on the front line at the minute?
Yes, I most certainly have got a message for them. I can see, as everyone can see, the job that you guys are doing. And it's an absolute privilege to watch you do that job so well under such difficult circumstances. Things are very tough for you guys at the minute, and you're going through some very, very tough times. But what I do know from experience is that coming through those situations is going to make you stronger and better people in the long run. You have the training in place to allow you to cope with that. More importantly, you belong in an environment that champions teamwork, and the one fundamental of teamwork, and that is putting the other person first. That's what you're all demonstrating now. That's what you'll demonstrate in the future. And that's what will make you stronger as a group, because you know you can rely on the person next to you. So remember your training, remember your teamwork, and remember, however tough things get, they will get better. There's light at the end of the tunnel. And pretty soon we'll all be raising a glass to a job well done the other side of this crisis.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, or also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They're like much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.